Chapters of Life by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 8, Meditation. The great tree towered heavenwards, with branches groping blindly towards the giver of light. Upon the ground its shadow stretched black and long, becoming longer and yet longer as the sun sailed across the lathering sky on its eternal journey. The tree basked and thrived beneath the life-giving rays. In its branches, concealed by multitudes of leaves, birds fluttered and called and occasionally flew swiftly to other trees in pursuit of their business of living. From some hidden recess within the tree's foliage came a sudden sharp squawk of an outraged bird in protest against an invading monkey. The squawks continued and rose in a crescendo as a whole troop of monkeys swung from branch to branch. Suddenly, as though at the turning of a switch, expectant silence fell upon the people of the tree. Humans were approaching. Along a faint path through the bushes, a bent old man stumbled and made his way. Clutching a sturdy stave in a gnarled hand, he plodded grimly forward. Behind him, two young men carried small bundles. The old man stopped and pointed to the tree. "We shall stop there," he said. "We shall rest a while, and I shall meditate through the night." Together they moved forward into the little clearing where the great tree's bulging roots made deep furrows and mounds. Together they walked around the mighty trunk, seeking the best position. Soon they found a spot where a large flat-topped boulder protruded from the ground on the sunward side of the bowl. A monkey was sprawled upon its top, leisurely scratching. At sight of the approaching men, it screeched in fright and leaped straight up to disappear amid the concealing branches. The younger of the two assistants carefully gathered some old branches from a nearby bush. Binding them tightly with a length of pliant vine, he soon had a serviceable brush with which he attacked the top of the rock, sweeping it clean of debris. With loving care, the other assistant took a sharp-edged stone and went with it to a lawn-like stretch of brilliant green moss. Kneeling, he pressed deep with the sharp stone and moved along until he had a rough outline of the boulder's top in the moss. Gently, he peeled the layer of moss and rolled it back like a carpet. With the aid of the younger man, he carried it forward and spread it out upon the rock, forming a thick cushion that aged bones might be protected from the harsh stone. Tightening his tattered robe, the old man clambered with surprising agility to the verdant surface. The brilliant rays of the fast-setting sun sent multitudinous colors across the wooded countryside, here gilding a treetop, there shining blood-red through the lower branches. Quickly the elder of the two assistants prepared their simple meal, a little parched barley, a sprinkling of rice, a small ripe mango fruit, and sparkling water from a nearby stream. Soon the meager repast was finished, and the utensils cleaned and put away in the small bundles. "I will meditate," said the old man, settling himself cross-legged and drawing his robe about him. "Do not disturb me. I will say when I am ready." The two assistants nodded in respectful acknowledgment. Turning away, they retired some many feet from the rock, rolled themselves more tightly in their robes and composed themselves for sleep. Suddenly the sun plunged below the rim of the earth, and the soft-scented purple iridescence of an Indian night reigned as the Lord of the Night awakened all the small nocturnal creatures to set about their business. Somewhere a sleepy bird muttered a last chirp, chirp to his mate before settling down to dream, maybe of fat worms and juicy fruits. Slowly the purple of the night turned to lustrous silver as the goddess of lovers climbed into the sky and showered her light upon the sleeping world. The gentle breezes of the night came to sweep away the odors of the day, to fondly ruffle the small forest flowers now folded in sleep, and carry fresh scents to those who dwelt by night. The hours crept slowly on. The moon lowered her light below the distant horizon, and light fleecy clouds sailed serenely above the earth. The old man sat erect, unmoving, withdrawn, meditating. Little creatures came forth from burrows and warrens to peer with round, unwinking eyes, and, seeing no danger to them, went on with their lawful business. The old man sat erect, unmoving, meditating, as the first streaks widened and turned into the gray gloom of early dawn. Somewhere a sleeping monkey was jostled and shrieked and gibbered in drowsy fury. Swiftly the light grew brighter, and a tinge of warmth swept across the night-chilled land. From the trees came the calls and fluttering of newly awakened birds. With a scream of terror, a small monkey, inexperienced yet, lost his grip and fell a dozen feet before fear-paralyzed limbs could reach out, grasp a branch, and swing to safety. The old man sat on, unmoving, as his assistants climbed to their feet, rubbing the sleep from their eyes. Much later in the day, as the hot sun poured down its waves of heat, the old monk ended his long meditation and partook of a frugal breakfast. Turning to the elder of the assistants, he said, "It is time you learned the art of meditation, my son, for I have observed you well, and your time of instruction has come." "But is it so difficult to meditate, master? Cannot anyone do it?" asked the younger. "No, my son," replied the old man. "Some people never meditate because they are not worthy, and some who are worthy do not meditate because they do not know how. Meditation is an art which must be imparted. It is an art which can lift one's ego to sublime heights." He paused in thought for a moment and then said to the younger, "Today you travel alone to seek out food. I must instruct your senior. In time, if you are worthy, your opportunity will come." So many people say that they are going to meditate, but of course most of these people have not the faintest idea of what real meditation means. They think that it is some mystical thing, whereas, as in the case of most metaphysical matters, meditation is simple and is just a means to an end, a method whereby one can obtain certain results. One of the great difficulties confronting the average student of metaphysical matters is that most of the original training and most of the original research was done in Tibet and in India, where civilizations flourished centuries before there were any civilizations at all in the Western world. Of course, There was also the great civilization of ancient China, but although China has been lauded as being of great religious stature, actually China was more interested in the arts of war. The civilizations of China gave us such dubious assets as explosives, high-flying kites which discharge showers of poisoned arrows, and surprisingly enough, the Chinese of centuries ago were the first to employ rocket warfare. Their atom bombs were great masses of flaming material carried on rocket heads. These flaming masses were fired into the enemy positions, where they set fire to men and material indiscriminately. China also gave us arts and crafts, which, of course, is to be commended, but China mainly took the religions of India and altered them to suit Chinese ideas. Japan can be disregarded because, until a few years ago, Japan was a secluded island country impervious to the influences of other countries, and, as the real history of Japan tells us, they merely copied their religions and their culture from the Chinese. Where the Japanese found their cruelty, as shown in the Second World War, can only be a matter of conjecture, but assuredly they lead the world in crude and cruel practices, and it is somewhat of a surprise that these little people are now tolerated among other nations. No doubt this is called commerce instead of friendship. One of the great difficulties, to get back to our original theme, is that, in translating Sanskrit and other Eastern languages, it is not always possible to convey the exact meaning in a Western language such as English. The Western languages deal more with concrete matters, whereas the languages of the far, far East deal with abstract concepts, and thus it is that so many things which depend upon the precise use of an idiom and which are not paralleled in another language lead translators astray and cause grave misunderstandings. An illustration is in the case of nirvana, a term that we should really understand in the Eastern meaning, and which will, therefore, shortly be referred to before going on to meditation, what it is and how to do it. India had a great civilization, a civilization which was highly spiritual in nature. India, in fact, was the cradle of true religion in this particular cycle of evolution, and many nations copied and altered Indian religions. In some stages of the culture of ancient China, when spirituality and veneration of one's ancestors was of greater importance than Chairman Mao or war, religions flourished. But some of the Chinese, and some of the Indians too, took their religious beliefs too literally, because religion should be a signpost, a guide, a manual of behavior. The Indians and Chinese forgot that, and it was often the case that a Chinese or an Indian would spend his life sitting beneath a tree in idle contemplation, thinking, "Oh, I will just take it easy during this lifetime. I can make up for it when I come to this earth again." That is not a figure of speech. That's not an exaggeration. It's a fact. And until a very short time ago, it was perfectly possible for a Chinaman to incur a debt in this life on the understanding that he would pay it back with interest in the next life. Can you imagine a Western moneylender? I see now they call themselves high-class finance companies. Advancing a sum of money today on the understanding that it would be paid back to him when he came in his next incarnation? Certainly it would lead to some amusing bookkeeping. To repeat, Eastern languages deal mainly with abstract and spiritual concepts, whereas Western languages deal with terms dealing with aviation or money or lack of it and other mundane subjects. You may be interested to know that a few years ago the Japanese had no ideographs, no written form of expression which would deal with technical terms in radio or engineering, and so to my own personal knowledge, Japanese technicians could only discuss radio, engineering, and other scientific concepts by learning the appropriate terms in English. There is nothing particularly remarkable about that because we have somewhat the same state of affairs in Western countries where two doctors of different nationalities and not understanding a word of each other's language could still discuss medical terms and treatments by using the common language of Latin. Radio operators, including amateurs, can converse quite well by using abbreviations and highly stylized codes so that they can understand each other even though the language of each other is unknown to the other. Possibly you have heard of QRM, meaning noise or static, or QRT, which asks a person to be silent. Nirvana is a word or concept which is usually quite beyond Western comprehension. Probably Nirvana is the most misunderstood of Eastern terms. People in the West think that the good Easterner just wants to sit and smell the flowers, in this case the lotus, and make himself into nothingness. It is often thought that Nirvana is total extinction of life, leading to a state where nothing exists, where nothing is, where there is no memory, no action, nothing. Nirvana is too frequently regarded by the Westerners as an example of the perfect vacuum, and they shun Eastern religions which they think, in their ignorance, lead to a state of complete and utter nothingness. This is absolutely incorrect. Nirvana does not mean a heaven or the opposite. It does not mean a place where there is nothing whatever, not even a place. It is not possible to exist in a state of nothingness, and yet again, the average Westerner thinks that the adept or master or guru or enlightened one strives to attain to a state where he forgets everything which he has striven to learn, and in which he no longer knows anything, no longer feels anything, no longer exists. This is ridiculous. This is fantastically absurd, and one would have thought that ordinary common sense would have indicated that there is no possibility of existing where nothing can exist. The adepts, the guru, the master, or enlightened one, or whatever you like to call him, seeks nirvana. Nirvana is not the negation of everything, as is usually supposed. It is, instead, the elimination of those desires which are wrong. It is the elimination of scandal, the elimination of perjury, greed, lust, and other faults. The enlightened ones strive so that they are empty of evil emotion, and thus their soul can rise within them and leave the body at will. Before people can do conscious astral traveling, they have to purge their thoughts. They have to be sure they do not want to travel just for idle curiosity or so that they can peer in on the private affairs of another person. It is absolutely essential that before a person can astral travel consciously and under full control, they must get rid of gross lusts and desires. In the Far East, many people can astral travel consciously. Many people who are on the spiritual path, that is. But in the East, the facts of life are treated differently, and we may have cause to deal with that later. In the Western world, it is rare indeed for a person to consciously astral travel while the sins of the flesh keep the souls enchained. One of the more usual methods of keeping the soul in bonds is the wrong sort of sex life. There should be no sex life whatever unless the man and woman are in love. If these people are in love, then a normal sex life increases the strength of the auric current of each, bringing luster and clarity to the color of the aura, as any clairvoyant can tell. If a man and woman engage in a sexual life just for mere animal pleasure, then they darken the colors of the aura, and they weaken the fluctuations of the current. Many of the Eastern schools of occult thought warn and warn again that the wrong sort of sex should not be indulged in if one is trying to progress. Unfortunately, Western translations or mistranslations state that the Easterner has no sex life at all in spiritual planes. This again is wrong. Sex is all right if the two people need it and if they are truly in love. In the Indian temples, and in the Tibetan temples too, there are pictures which Western people, in their blindness, have thought to be erotic, obscene, or pornographic. It is not so, and it does not in any way upset the Easterner to gaze upon these pictures. They see the pictures for what they are. They see that this is a reminder of what can be. The sexual act is the generation of life. It is the generation of stronger auric currents, and the pictures which truly adorn the walls of temples in India and Tibet show the true sexual life and also the wrong sexual life, so that the initiate may compare the two, because after all, how can you know what is wrong unless someone shows you? And how can you do a thing correctly unless someone tells you that also? The wrong form of sexual life leads to unpleasant manifestations, frigidity, nervous troubles, and causes a suppression of the better instincts of man and woman. While the correct form of sexual life, for those who need it, leads to an increase in the spiritual abilities of both. After a time, as the initiate progresses and becomes the enlightened one, he can do without the fellowship of those around him. He can do without a sex life, and, contrary to what certain people believe, he does not lose anything thereby. Sex life on earth is a very physical thing, But as one progresses higher and higher, the experiences are even stronger, even better, and you may be surprised to know, when one leaves this earth for the next life, it is utterly necessary, a must, in fact, that one has a knowledge of the opposite sex in order that one can obtain balance. This is a good point to say that we should not be deluded by all those peculiar people who claim that they are great experts, great masters, great know-alls, in fact, because they have read a few books. Books do not give experience. One can read a book and be without knowledge after. It is fantastic for a man or a woman to proclaim from the housetops that he or she is a great enlightened adept because he or she has read a book by such and such a person, and that so often occurs. Quite recently I had a letter from an illiterate fellow in Australia who claimed to be a great teacher and a great master. He assured me that he was an avatar. He knew he was this because his wife had told him so, and because he'd read a book or two and talked a lot. The real yardstick is this: what experience has a person had? Would you, for example, trust your life to an airline pilot who had only read a book about flying? Would you sail from here to another continent on a ship commanded by a captain and officers who had merely taken a correspondence course on ship management and navigation? Obviously not. Using the same reasoning, you should not entrust your training to any person who has just read a few books or who's had a correspondence course, which they want to sell you for high payment for the rest of your life. Before you study anything, you should be acquainted with the experience of the person whom you're going to trust to teach you. Well, it's time we get back to meditation. So many people do not know what meditation is. What is it? Meditation is a special form of concentration or directed thinking which disciplines the mind and which forms a special attitude of mind. Meditation is that form of directed thought which enables us to perceive through the subconscious and other systems that would not be possible for us to perceive in any other way. Meditation is of extreme importance as it awakens the mind to higher consciousness and permits the mind to tap in more freely to the subconscious, just as a person can have a large library and go to his books for special information. Unless that person knows where to look, he can have his large library, but they will just be so much wasted paper. The discipline of meditation is essential if one is to make any real progress in spiritual attainment. Just as an army would be useless without discipline and without drill, so the human psyche becomes as a member of a rabble without the discipline and training of meditation correctly applied. It is useless to try to practice meditation by reading a book which has been written by a person who cannot himself meditate. So many occult books are just indigestible conglomerations of misunderstood Eastern parables. Books which are written by people who really do not know the first thing about meditation. For it is clear that unless one can meditate oneself, one cannot tell other people how to meditate. It should be remembered that in many countries of the world, non-Christian countries that is, attendants at a temple would meditate before entering the temple. They would meditate so that their mind was clear and opened, ready to receive what one might term in Western parlance divine revelation and instruction. It is quite useless to pray, for example, if one is just giving a babble of instruction to one's God. It is useless to pray that one shall win the beauty contest or one shall win the Irish sweepstake. The process of praying should always be commenced by a period of meditation, which clears the mind of the garbage of thought and makes one ready to receive information from higher planes. To repeat, too many people flop down on their knees and start ordering their God to deliver the goods. Then they say that prayer never works. Well, let them try meditation first. Meditation actually has four different parts. The first part is that meditational practice which assists in the development of the true personality of the meditator, and if one can meditate and develops one's personality, then one obtains a happier and more successful life. One becomes happier in the personal aspects of life, and one becomes more successful in association with one's fellows, that is, in work. Successful meditation here also increases the mental capacity. The second stage of meditation is that which almost automatically follows from successful completion of the first stage. The second stage of meditation is that which brings the physical body in rapport with the Overself and brings the Overself in rapport with the Manu of the nation. Before one can meditate to this and higher standards, it is essential that one has a pure and lust-free life. The third stage of meditation is that which gives one all the benefits of stage 1 and 2, but which enables one, in addition, to have full occult understanding. That is, when one reaches the third stage of meditation, one is able to comprehend and apperceive. Apperceive, of course, is different from perceive. Apperceive is the mind's perception of itself, all that which enables the Overself to improve its own spiritual condition. And lastly, there is the mystical meditation, so-called because it is so far removed from earthly concepts that it is rather beyond the understanding of those who have not succeeded in reaching that stage. The fourth stage of meditation takes us, by way of the silver cord, up to our Overself, and then by way of the golden cord of our Overself, into the presence of that great entity which, for want of a better term down here, we call God. But the first two stages of meditation are the essential steps, and you should concentrate on them first. Before taking up meditation, it is essential that there shall be a discipline, because if one is playing with meditation, one is playing with fire. You should not allow a child to play with a barrel of gunpowder and a box of matches. At least you would allow him to do it only once. In the same way, You must exercise great restraint in practicing the higher stages of metaphysics. If you get a little weed of a man who suddenly decides that he wants to gain the muscles of Mr. Atlas, he has to undergo certain exercises. The poor fellow cannot suddenly grab a barbell, etc., and put in 24 hours a day at exercises. He would have a breakdown. In the same way, it is quite necessary that meditation be regarded as the exercises of the soul. And if you rush into the practice of meditation like an American tourist rushing through the Vatican just to say that he'd been there, then you will find that your enthusiasm will wane. You must practice according to a prearranged plan with discipline and much prior preparation, because our weedy little man, if he practices too much and lifts too much and exercises too much, he will find that he is so stiff in his muscles that he can hardly move. But you, remember, with meditation, you can become stiff in the mind, and that is a horrible state of affairs. So in spite of all of this, you want to meditate. You want to really go in for this thing? Well, let's see how you like the next bit. To meditate, you must have an absolutely quiet time in your day, and you should make that time in the early morning. This is one of the reasons why priests, etc., meditate before they eat. You should have no food before meditating. And you should not meditate in bed. If you try that, you'll fall asleep. So, make arrangements to awaken about 1 hour earlier than usual, and when your alarm goes off and wakens you, get out of bed. Wash and dress, because the process of washing and dressing will awaken you so much that you will not be tempted to crawl back into bed and sleep. If you really want to do this thing seriously, you will have one corner of a room as your own inner sanctuary. You will have a little shrine which will enable you to fix your attention on that which you are trying to do. So, for those who are truly serious, here is how to proceed. Have a room, even a box room will do, as a sanctuary, and keep the door of that room locked when you are not in it. Have a little table in a corner covered with a white cloth. Upon the white cloth, have an image of, for example, a Hotai, the symbol of good living. No, you're not worshipping graven images. Hotai is merely a symbol. Have an incense burner and a stick of thick incense, which you should light and then blow it out so that it just smolders in pleasant smoke. It will help if you have previously timed the burning of the incense, such as, for instance, to the half hour, so that when your incense goes out, you cease your meditation. The serious meditator will wear a special meditation robe, because the whole idea of the meditation robe is that you are shielding yourself from outside influences. The meditation robe must be very full, with long loose sleeves and with a cowl to pull over the head. You can get these of thin black silk, or if you find that too expensive, thin black cotton. When the meditation robe is not in use, it should be put back into a black silk case where it cannot be touched by other clothing. You may think all this is rather theatrical, but it is not, you know. It's the best way of getting the results desired. And if you want the desired results, you have to work according to the rules. So, wear your meditation robe when you're going to meditate. Now that you have your room, your meditation robe, your hotai, and your incense, go to the room and sit down quietly. It does not matter how you sit. You do not have to sit cross-legged. Sit in any way which is comfortable to you and which prevents you from getting cramps or twinges, because in the early stages you cannot meditate if you're in discomfort. When you have sat for a few moments in quiet contemplation, you should repeat the prayer, "Let me this day, living my life day by day in the manner prescribed, control and direct my imagination. Let me this day, living my life day by day in the manner prescribed, control my desires and my thoughts, that I be purified thereby. Let me this day and all days keep my imagination and my thoughts directed firmly upon the task which has to be accomplished, that success may come thereby. I will at all times live my life day by day, controlling imagination and thought." You will have seen that the room is not light, of course, but very well shaded, fairly dark in fact, so that everything appears gray rather than black. You will soon find the amount of darkness which suits you best. If you take a glass of cold water and hold that glass between your two hands so that your palms and fingers are around the glass but not overlapping onto the top, you will find that you will be in a suitable position for another exercise. Now slide the fingers of one hand so that they fit in between the spaces of the fingers of the other hand, so that you have as much of your hands and fingers on the glass as you can manage. Sit quietly and take a deep breath. Try those exercises which are mentioned in my book, The Wisdom of the Ancients, but take a deep breath and allow the air to be exhaled with a long, long, drawn-out sound. The sound is you must do it aloud. You do not have to shout it. You can do it softly, although very clearly. And you must treat it seriously because it is a serious practice. Repeat this 3 times, then sit and watch for several minutes as the odonetic, or magnetized, water focuses the etheric of the body into a cloud around the glass of water. The etheric will condense so that you should easily see the quite heavy haze, which will remind you of blue cigarette smoke condensed into a cloud, or, if you prefer, remind you of incense smoke condensed into a cloud. When you have done this for a week or two, or perhaps a month or two, depending upon your seriousness, you will be able to see some of your life force in the water. And when the life force gets into the water, it charges the water just the same as soda water sparkles. But the sparks and sparkles that you will see from your own life force will be flashes of light, lines and swirlings of various colors. Do not rush things, because you have plenty of time. After all, you do not grow an oak tree overnight, and the more serious you are, the more success you will have, and the success eventually will turn that glass of water into a miniature universe with sparkles of multi-hued fire darting and swirling within the confines of the glass. you should arrange your meditation into a definite pattern or timetable. It's a very good idea to have a rosary so that you can keep check on your stages of meditation. You can obtain a Buddhist rosary, or you can make your own rosary of different sizes of beads, but no matter what method you use, you should keep to a very rigid timetable. You must meditate in the same room and at the same time and wearing the same meditation robe. Start by selecting one thought or one idea and sitting quietly before your little altar. Try to eliminate all outside thoughts. Center your attention within yourself, and there meditate upon that idea which you have decided upon. As you concentrate, you will find that a faint shaking starts within you. That is normal. That faint vibration shows that the meditation system is working. Here are some suggestions. 1. Have, as a first meditation, the meditation of love. In this, you think kind thoughts towards all creatures who live. If enough people think kind thoughts, then eventually some of it will rub off on other people. And if we could get enough people to think kind thoughts instead of vicious thoughts, the world would be a very different place. 2. After the first meditation of love, you can concentrate on the second meditation, which causes you to think of those in distress. As you think of those in distress, you really live their sorrows and their miseries. And out of your compassion, you send thoughts, or rays, of understanding and sympathy. 3. In the third meditation, you think of the happiness of others. You rejoice that at last they have attained the prosperity and all that for which they long. You think of these things, and you project to the outside world thoughts of joy. 4. The fourth meditation is the meditation of evil. In this, you allow your mind to meditate upon sin and illness. You think how narrow is the margin between sanity and insanity, health and sickness. You think how brief is the pleasure of the moment, and how all-encompassing the evil of giving in to the pleasure of the moment. Then you think of the sorrow which can be caused by pandering to evil. 5. The fifth meditation is that in which we attain serenity and tranquility. In the meditation of serenity, you rise above the mundane plane. You rise above feelings of hate. You soar above even feelings of earthly love, because earthly love is a very poor substitute for the real thing. In the meditation of serenity, you are no longer bothered by oppression, nor do you fear, nor do you want wealth for its own sake, but only for the good which it can bring to others with it. In the meditation of serenity, you can regard your own future with tranquility, knowing that you, at all times, are going to do your best and live your life according to your own stage of evolution. Those who have attained to such a state are well on the way to evolution, and those who are can place reliance upon their knowledge and upon their inner knowledge to free them from the wheel of birth and death. You may wonder what comes after meditation. Well, trance comes. comes after. We have to use the word trance for want of a better term. Actually, trance is a state of meditation in which the real you goes out and leaves the body, as one would part from and leave a car. Now, as we all know frequently to our cost, if one has a parked car, one sometimes gets that car stolen by car thieves. In the same way, if people meditate deeply enough to enter what we must term the trance state, without clearing their minds of lust, etc., then they invite stealing by other entities. The trance state is a highly dangerous state unless one first practices under capable supervision. There are various forms of elementals and discarnate entities who are always prowling about to see how much mischief they can do, and if they can do a lot of mischief by taking over a person's body, then they're very happy to have some fun, just as teenagers will sometimes steal a car to go racing around the roads. No doubt the teenagers fully intend to return the car unharmed, but frequently the car is harmed, and so, when a body is taken over, frequently it is harmed. Let me repeat that if your thoughts are pure, if your intentions are pure, and if you are without fear, then you cannot be invaded, obsessed, or taken over. There is nothing to fear except fear itself. Let me repeat that. If you be not afraid, you radiate an aura which protects your body much the same way as a burglar alarm can protect a house. And if your thoughts are pure and you have no lusts, then when the lust of taking over a body tingles your consciousness, you immediately look down the silver cord and see what it is, just the same as a farmer keeps a watch on his orchard to protect his apples. You cannot be obsessed or taken over or invaded unless you are afraid. But if you are afraid of such things, well, for your own peace of mind and for your own peace of body, do not play with the deep trance stage of meditation. I am greatly opposed to hypnotism, except with the very greatest of safeguards. For if you are put into a hypnotic trance by an inexperienced person, he can have an awful lot of fears, wondering if you will be all right, wondering if he can get you out of the trance. The hypnotic trance is a passive trance. It is a trance which is caused by a series of powerful suggestions strengthened by a person's belief that he or she can be hypnotized. Actually, when a person is hypnotized, conditions are much the same as when a person goes cross-eyed, because the etheric double is thrown slightly out of synchronization, which means that the physical and the etheric bodies are no longer in complete coincidence with each other. If you get a bad hypnotist, he can do a tremendous amount of damage. He can harm you for years. After all, you would not go to a surgeon who's just learned his surgical technique by taking a correspondence course. You want a person who can operate surely and competently. So, for the sake of your health and your sanity, do not allow amateurs to meddle about with you. If you want, for some reason, to be hypnotized, then get in touch with some medical association in your own area, and they'll be able to tell you of some ethical medical hypnotist who has been trained under carefully supervised conditions. You may think that I'm overstressing the dangers, but oh, you should see some of the letters that I receive about harm which has been caused by inept, criminally careless dabblers in hypnotism. Remember that when you are hypnotized, your soul is pushed out of coincidence with the centers of your consciousness. In the case of mediums, they are often people who get into a dreamy state of trance, a dreamy state of hypnosis, for consciously or unconsciously they lightly hypnotize themselves so that they are hyper-suggestible, and in such a case they can be used as a telephone by people on the other side of life. But remember what we have said, what we have learned together about discarnate entities. The really good people who have passed over are too busy to fool around giving messages at seances. Under certain conditions, of course, one can have a very skilled and conscientious person who can go into this trance in the physical and still remain alert in the astral, and so can, in effect, supervise the type of person who is giving messages to the group of sitters below. This is a very useful tool when one is doing detailed research, but it is utterly essential to make sure that the seance be not interrupted by noise or by the unexpected entry of other people. There is a very special form of occult trance. The adept calls its temple sleep, and this is an absolutely different type of trance from any of those previously mentioned, because the initiate who has studied all this under temple conditions knows what he is doing, and he can throw himself deliberately into the trance state just the same as a person can throw himself into a car and drive off. He is under his own control and cannot be obsessed by others. But, of course, this depends upon having years of practice, and until a person has had the necessary experience, he should always be under the most careful supervision of a person who has had such experience. The average person playing about with trance states has a very useful protective system. You try playing about with the trance, and if you're a normal, decent person, you'll find that you fall asleep. That prevents you from being invaded by discarnate entities. But even here, there are two grave danger spots. For example, you are awake, even though in a trance state, but then you fall asleep. Now, at the instant when you are between awake and asleep, you are vulnerable to obsession, just the same as you are vulnerable to obsession when under these conditions you have gone to sleep and now awaken. Please note that this only refers to when people are playing about with hypnotism or trances, and there is no danger whatever in the awake-asleep and asleep-awake of ordinary day and night living. It follows from all of this that you would not be very wise to meddle with trance states unless you are carefully supervised. In certain temples, the person being trained is supervised by two senior lamas who are able to keep contact with whatever the acolyte is thinking. And by their gentle but firm guidance, the acolyte is prevented from doing any harm to himself or having caused any harm to anyone else. When the acolyte can pass certain tests, then he is permitted to go into deep trances by himself, and usually one of the first things he will do is to go into a very deep trance, what we term the trance of vision. This is a deep trance indeed, and the initiate will be completely immobile. He might appear to be utterly rigid, even with hard flesh. In this particular state, he is still within his body, but is very much like a man on top of a high tower who has a high-powered telescope, which enables him to see very clearly and greatly magnified. The man with the telescope can turn in any direction and can see what is going on with startling clarity. One does not get out of the body in the trance of vision. Instead, you have to wait and practice the trance of projection before you can get out. And in this case, the body is limp and flaccid and is in a cataleptic condition with all consciousness being withdrawn, and the body remaining, as it were, under the supervision of the caretaker. Breathing goes on at a very much reduced rate, and the heartbeat is reduced, and life just flows very leisurely indeed. First of all, when you get in these trances, you will wonder if what you are seeing is imagination. But with practice, you will know that which is real and will easily detect that which is merely a thought projection from some other entity, whether incarnate or discarnate. To give you an illustration, you are somewhere, anywhere you like, sitting at peace and doing deep trance meditation. If you let your consciousness wander willy-nilly, without having much control of it, you might find yourself near a person who's had too much to drink, and you may be horrified to see all manner of queer animals wriggling around him. Yes, those striped elephants really do exist in thought form. Worse than that, though, supposing you allow yourself to just wander and you find yourself near a very, very bad-tempered man with murder in his heart. If he's thinking of murder, then you poor sufferer, will see the actual scenes as if they were reality instead of just thought, and you may come back to your body with such a jerk that you will get a headache for the next 24 hours thinking that you have witnessed a murder or worse. The initiated metaphysician can easily recognize that which is real and that which is imaginary, but it is again advised that unless you have some real reason for deep trance, you leave it alone. If you will not heed that advice, well, heed this. If in a deep trance or in the astral you find horrible entities making faces at you or worse, then you merely have to think strong thoughts at them that you are not afraid. And if you can do that, you'll find that these people disappear. They can only feed on fear. And if you're not afraid, they are actually repelled. In sincere friendship, I advise you not to allow yourself to be hypnotized except by a competent medical person, and I advise you not to undergo trance except under qualified supervision. The ordinary meditation is perfectly safe. No harm at all can come to you because you're in full possession of all your faculties. So, meditate and enjoy it immensely. Avoid hypnotism and deep trance because they will not further your development one iota. End of chapter 8.